Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend's edition. And boy oh boy, we have a lot to talk about as this was another very interesting week, especially on the back of that inflation data and some of those moves that we were seeing in precious metals and actually a wide range of markets for us to cover here. We are going to, again, focus on all of these topics, but I do want to just remind everybody that you should go back to our website throughout the week. That is kereport.com and listen to all of the market commentaries and a lot of company updates that we recorded, especially now with a bit more interest coming back into the resource sector and resource stocks. Some of these stocks are starting to finally move off of good results, and that's what we keep on trying to share with everybody. That being said, we're kicking off the show with Mike Larson. He is the editor of the Safe Money Report. And Mike, we're going to start off with inflation because we're recording this late in the day on Wednesday. We had the inflation data that came out earlier today. And quite frankly, inflation is hitting 30-year highs. I know you even have an addendum that says it's actually a longer term that we have seen this kind of inflation, but we saw CPI over 6%, 6.2%, the core rate 4.6%. This is flying in the face of all those transitory comments that we had from the Fed, and quite frankly, all those people that said, oh, inflation's not going to last that long. Inflation is sticking around. That being said, we're also still seeing some pretty good growth for the economy. Start us off with your takeaway from the recent inflation data that continues to exceed estimates.
Sure. I mean, I guess I'd start off by saying some of the forecasting, especially at the Fed on this inflation front, has been as atrocious as we saw in the mid-2000s when they were talking about, you know, their views on the housing bubble. If you look at what they've been saying about inflation for many, many months now, they've been wrong, dead wrong. I don't know how you want to call it. But these numbers have been much worse than expected. They've been more persistent than expected. And they clearly show that the economy coming out of the COVID recovery had so much fiscal stimulus thrown at it, so much monetary stimulus thrown at it during the depths of the crisis. But instead of gradually weaning the economy off of that as the economy improved and we came out of the worst of the pandemic, what did they do? They kept the foot not on the gas pedal, not just to the baseboards, but all the way through the car and into the road beneath. So what you've seen happen in this environment of dramatic excess liquidity and enormous amounts of fiscal stimulus being thrown at the market is inflation, the likes of which officially at 6.2% is the worst we've had since 1990. But here, when you look at what happened in 1990, what happened late that year, that's when Iraq invaded Kuwait. And then a few months later, we had Gulf War I. So if you're willing to be an apologist, like a lot of these people trotted out to talk about the Fed today and say, oh, this is supply side only, it's not the Fed's fault. Once these supply bottlenecks will be fixed, inflation's going to go away. And you say it's a one-off transitory thing, well, then certainly you have to go back and say, 30 years ago, it was a one-off transitory thing. I mean, it was a war, right? So if you exclude the spike in 1990, this actually becomes the worst inflation figures we've seen all the way since 1982, when the economy was, inflation was coming down from the double-digit economy-crushing interest rates that Volcker had to put in place to get rid of the inflation we had in the 1970s and early 80s. So long story short, it's really more like the worst inflation data in 39 years, and you have sort of these deer-in-headlights policymakers who not only got this whole thing completely wrong, but don't know what to do about it. I mean, you have a situation now where if you look at a 6.2% inflation rate, you compare that to a federal funds rate of, a range of 0 to 0.25%, or if you look at the 10-year treasury or 30-year treasury around 1.5% and 2% respectively, just under those levels, you're talking about real interest rates, inflation-adjusted interest rates that are the most negative they've ever been or the most negative they've been since the early 1980s, depending on what measure you look at. That is extraordinarily loose monetary policy, an extraordinarily loose policy, even as the Fed is now finally talking about starting to taper things back. Again, just on a real interest rate level, you know, we've almost never been this negative. So what does that mean? That leads to rampant asset market speculation. I mean, you know, we've had 20%+ gains in real estate prices in some parts of the country. We've had the stock market on fire, you know, up until this week, up about 26% year to date for the S&P. You've got all these idiotic companies coming public and people finding buyers for it. You know, we're trading dog coins, you know, up 30,000% from a year earlier and stuff like that. I mean, there's all this excess liquidity that's really led to asset market bubbles. And now from the inflation data, you're seeing a lot of that spill over. So it's really an environment where policymakers have been dead wrong. The policy itself has been dead wrong for what's been going on. And now it's a kind of a, everybody's staring around like, how are we going to get out of this? You know, what do we do? And I think if you look at the bond market, what it's telling you, long-term interest rates, 30, if you talk about the 30-year U.S. Treasury bond, it actually peaked back in March, which you think that's crazy. How can, with these terrible inflation numbers, how are our long-term U.S. bonds not getting crushed? Even recently, you know, we just tested that 1.8% level before bouncing sharply off of it after a lousy Treasury bond auction. Why is that happening? And why is the yield curve flattening, meaning short-term interest rates are going up much faster than long-term interest rates? Because the bond market knows that from a political standpoint, from a real politic, the Fed can't sit on its hands anymore. They can't just sit there, you know, and, you know, whatever, don't answer the phone when the Biden administration calls and says, what the heck are you doing? You're killing me here. They can't sit by and look at this kind of inflation data and with a straight face go in front of a room full of reporters and say, oh, we totally expected this. This is nothing. And I don't care if it's a Zoom room full of reporters. That's how they're doing it now. You add it all together and you've got a Fed that's kind of trapped. You've got an inflation situation, which is, you know, really crushing real earnings and real income. I mean, you put your money in a bank getting a CD that pays you whatever, 20 basis points or something, and inflation 620 basis points. You lose 6% of your money in a one-year CD just doing nothing. I mean, that's why this environment is so crazy, and it really is going to lead to some fireworks, I think.
Yeah, Mike, it's soul-crushing for the savers out there that if they put it in a money market, a CD, even a fixed annuity, they're getting eroded by inflation so much faster. As you pointed out, it's the most negative real rates have been in quite some time, if not ever. And if you think back to what the Fed's messaging was, to your point, they were just cheering inflation on. We got to get it to 2%. Hey, you know what? It's a little bit over 2%, but we want it to run a little hotter. Well, great, guys. You've now tripled it. Now it's at 6% and rising. So there's a point now where they're going to hit a fork in the road. And I'm curious to get your thoughts on this, Mike. When they start tapering like they have, and we get 3 to 4 months into this, and they start pulling back their bond buying, but everybody sees inflation still taking off, there's a point they're going to have to address the rate hikes. And do you think there's a market realization now that there's really no way mathematically they could normalize rates and get interest rates even close to 5 or 6%, even if inflation was to drop off next year? How could they ever even get it close? Do you think that realization is setting in?
You have kind of this fantasy land, progressive, extreme thinking when it comes to monetary policy and fiscal policy that, oh, you know, let's help the little person by getting them big wage increases by keeping policy really, really loose. Okay, well, wages have gone up quite a bit, 3-4%, depending on what measure you look at. But what they don't tell you is, hey, okay, you got a 4% raise, but your cost of living went up 6%. Guess what? You just lost 2% in real terms. You know, so this whole progressive idea that we're going to just keep policy super loose, we're not going to care about bubbles, we're not going to care about out-of-control asset markets, stupid risk-taking on Wall Street, and, you know, real-world inflation because we're just going to focus on employment, it's silly. And, you know, who's getting hurt by this? You know, are you helping that person, the lower to middle income person, when they can't afford a house, they can't afford college, they can't afford medical insurance, they can't afford groceries? I mean, how are you really doing anybody a favor in the real world by letting ignoring this kind of inflation and, you know, just saying, oh, this policy is great? It's really silly. And, you know, now, again, from a political standpoint, they simply can't keep things this loose. They can't ignore this stuff. Because, I mean, you remember what happened in the mid-2000s, Bernanke going out there and talking about subprime being contained and, oh, there's no nationwide housing bubble, all that claptrap. I mean, we could see it with our own eyes. You could see what was going on with house prices. You know, it didn't pass the smell test. And now, you know, you can't continue to trot out policymakers saying, oh, we're going to monitor this. Maybe the step is to take $25 billion out of next month's bond purchases instead of 20. That's like, you know, fighting a raging forest fire with a water pistol. I mean, it's not going to work, right? So I think that's why I say you're going to have to see policy react a lot more. You're going to have to see a real change in kind of Washington's approach to this. And I think that that's what the bond market's going to sniff out. And that's what I think we're going to see. We're going to see the yield curve get crushed because people are going to realize, and we already have seen it, frankly, but it's going to happen even further, is people are going to realize, you know, you can't sit there and with a straight face say, maybe someday in 2023, we're going to raise interest rates because, oops, right now, your cost of living is the worst in 39 years. I mean, that just doesn't, that just is an impossible intellectual position to take. And it's an impossible political position to take.
So, Mike, big picture, when it comes to this higher inflation data, I've been hearing the reasons for why inflation should be spiking for years, over a decade now. Low interest rates, easy money policy from central banks. But it's just now that we're finally starting to see this inflation, and it is coming right after these COVID lockdowns. And clearly, everyone was tied up at home, and the government was giving everybody money. And now it seems like people are out there spending that money, and in a way, not even arguing about some of these higher prices, or at least they're still out there buying products. Why now? What has changed so much in just the last year compared to the last over a decade that we are seeing this higher inflation?
Well, what did we see throughout the, you know, the mid 2000 or the 2010s? We saw rampant inflation. We just saw it in the asset market. We saw asset inflation, you know, stocks, bonds, risky bonds, real estate to some degree. I mean, it was happening. It's just in the last couple of decades, a lot more of the inflation out there has been money going into the non-productive and things like asset speculation and asset price rising because you're cutting the discount rate that future cash flows are valued at. You know, you cut interest rates further and further and you buy more and more bonds, which helps lower interest rates. What happens? You know, you value assets that generate income at a higher price today because you're discounting the future income you're going to get. It's just the way the math works, right? So we saw rampant asset inflation, you know, in the stock market again and housing to some degree and so on. You can look at things like household net worth relative to income, relative to, you know, other measures of things like GDP. Those ratios got way, way out of whack even before anybody heard of COVID. And now you've got a situation where on top of that sort of monetary stuff that always tends to go into assets or has in the last couple of decades, you throw in enormous amounts of fiscal aid at it. And you know, you've had a lot of policies that have kind of made things worse. Policies that, you know, some were, yes, disease driven, you know, necessities. You've got to shut down various things. You've got to be more careful and have, you know, less capacity and things like that. You know, but a lot of that's only part of the story. Part of the rest of it is just, again, keeping easy policy in place for too long. You know, and on top of that, having some of these supply things, on top of that, having trillions of fiscal being thrown at the economy, on top of trillions of monetary, and that's been the difference here, right? But again, you know, longer term, why do I think that the long end of the bond market, why do you think there's nowhere near the yields we saw in the early 80s? I mean, shoot, a 30-year bond was going for 14-15% in the early 80s in the U.S. You know, now, even after the sell-off late this week on the lousy bond auction, you're still talking about around 2% or a little bit less. That's because of the things we've talked about before, right? We have so much debt piled on top of the U.S. economy. We have, you know, issues like demographics, lower birth rates, less immigration. We have structural issues that make the economy less productive and so on. And all of that results in basically a lower long-term growth rate potential and an impossibility, an economy that can't handle high interest rates. I mean, shoot, if you shock interest rates to 15% now with the trillions and trillions and trillions more debt we have on the U.S. economy than we had in 1981 or 82, it'd be economic Armageddon. So even despite this lousy inflation news, the Fed's kind of trapped. It's going to probably have to raise interest rates, but it's not going to get them anywhere near what we saw in the past. It's going to crush the economy, and especially things like house prices and asset values if it goes too far. So you have a small group of policymakers that are truly caught between a rock and a hard place. And it's a different environment than they faced in a long, long time. You know, as an investor, again, you know, the things that I've talked about, reasonable dividend yield paying stocks, companies that have some, you know, benefit from inflation, obviously gold and silver. I mean, you know, we talked for the last few months. It's like, gosh, you know, when is you stare at gold, you stare at miners, you're like, God, what are they going to get off the mat? But the funny thing is, gold itself made its, you know, in the futures market, made a low back in March. It tagged it two more times, but it never really undercut that. Now here we are at a 5-6 month high. What's finally happening? People are putting two and two together. In this policy environment, I mean, why wouldn't you own precious metals for protection? Why wouldn't you own them for profit potential? I never my bull market thesis and my belief that it was just a longer term correction never really faded. And I certainly don't have any reason to change that opinion now.
Yeah, Mike, I was going to ask you about the move in precious metals just today on Wednesday, where, you know, it broke above that key resistance at 1840 that everybody was watching. Looks like it's going to close the market above that. But is this the beginning of a sustained move, do you think, where more people, more generalists are coming in? Because another strange thing that happened today was that the U.S. dollar started going up even higher, almost to a breakout level. It seemed like a run into the safe havens, and those people run into the safe havens only when they get a little rattled and the markets were selling off at the same time. Do you think this is the beginning of a more sustainable move into the safe havens, in particular the precious metals?
You know, I think that you've got safe haven buying that should be part of this. You've got the more deeply negative interest rates that should be a part of the factors behind gold. You've got, obviously, you know, we haven't seen a lot of supply coming to the market because it's been a muted environment for investing in mines and things like that. So, you know, you roll it all together, and I think you've got a lot of catalysts for this to be a notable and sustainable and extendable breakout. You know, we're going to have to see how gold behaves at these levels. I'd like to see 1850, 1860, maybe even 1870 and hold it there to kind of signal that a true sustainable next leg up is here. But yeah, I mean, you look at all these factors, I don't see any reason why gold can take out its highs that we had back at the peak of the bull market many, many months back, 2000, 2100, that kind of area.
How does this translate into the U.S. equity markets? Because look, the U.S. equity markets, even as you said and spot on, that the inflation was in the markets are still right around all-time highs. So does this environment also support the general melt-up in markets that we've seen?
You know, that's going to be real tricky. We're in a very strong seasonal time of year. But, you know, if the Fed is forced to really act and really crack down, that's going to lead to turbulence. I still think, again, it's so far behind the curve. We're so far from a tight money environment that it's not, you know, it shouldn't be any like disastrous thing. I'm not expecting like the market to crash or something. But, you know, it's potential for a decent correction if the Fed's hand is forced in the next couple of months, could happen. But I think that ultimately this isn't the kind of environment this early in the Fed cycle that you're going to want to be aggressively selling stocks. Once the yield curve inverts, once the Fed's really forced to go pretty far, once you have other credit issues popping up, that's later in every interest rate cycle in the past. I don't think that's going to be different here. So I don't think you really want to get aggressively short here or dump a bunch of stocks. But I do think you've got to be wary of what's going on in the interest rate market. Just keep that in the back of your mind.
Yeah, usually they say the recession precedes a flattening of the yield curve by about a year to 18 months. So that would still be further down the food chain since it's happening now. But the question, Mike, would be, do you think the Fed is going to be forced to start hiking before they're done tapering? And do you think that would have a general markets effect?
That is entirely possible, because I think you can't. There's a political element. I don't care how everybody says, oh, the Fed's political, and you know, they're both beyond politics. Come on, that's not how it works in the real world, even if theoretically that's how the structure is set up. So you're gonna see a lot of pressure brought to bear on the Fed to do something. You know, what that something is, is it more speechifying? Is it, you know, advancing when they raise rates for the first time? What it's gonna be, these kinds of numbers can't be ignored. And that's why I think, yeah, probably gets pulled forward. But again, even if they start hiking, you have to look at are rates anywhere near positive? Is the yield curve, yes, it's getting flatter, but is it close to inverting on key measures like 5s, 30s, or 2s, 10s? No, we're still quite a ways away from that. So I don't think that you're at a point, again, where, I always go back and say, if COVID had never happened, the yield curve had already inverted, we were already heading for recession anyway. The COVID outbreak just dramatically amplified and accelerated that process. But, you know, you still didn't want to sell stocks in 2018 and 2019, even as the curve was getting flatter, because there was still some upside, especially in things like utilities and defensive late cycle stocks. That's going to be the same case, in my opinion, here. You are going to get to the point where the curve does invert. You're going to get to the point where, you know, the Fed is really having to pour it on. That's when you want to get aggressively defensive. But I think that's still in the future.
So, Mike, as we progress through the last, let's say, month and a half of 2021, now that we have that long-anticipated Fed statement behind us and the start of the taper. What's going to be important to watch? Is it data? Is it markets? Is it any certain sector? What are you going to have your eye on?
You know, I think you got to keep your eye on the bond market very closely. Again, watch that curve, see if it's flattening dramatically. I mean, right now it seems to be flattening when rates go up, and it seems to be flattening when rates go down. So you're getting, you know, on days when they go down, the long end goes down more than the short end. On days when rates go up, the long end goes up less than the short end. As that process continues, if it does, as I expect, again, that's something you got to keep in the back of your mind. You got to see if something, you know, this lousy bond auction is followed by even more selling. If people get into that taper tantrum reaction, the stock market can't ignore that. And then you're going to want to see, I mean, there's a lot of speechifying coming from the Fed. I mean, how, you know, what are these people going to say in a straight face, and especially in interviews where the media can challenge them and be like, are you kidding me? what kind of comments are they going to have to say? That's what I'm going to be watching. So again, I'm not in this sort of like sell everything and go into a bunker type environment, but I think that you're probably going to get some choppy, you know, choppy trading here, and you want to keep your eye on the rates market.
All right. Perfect. Always enjoyable chatting with you here, Mike. Thanks for kicking off the show with us. We'll chat again in another couple of weeks, but this week, some of the moves that we're seeing, let's see if they continue the trend that precious metals are on, even the US dollar is on through the rest of this month. But hey, on the back of that Fed meeting, we are starting to see some other trends a bit more defined in the market. Mike, great chatting with you. As always, buddy, thank you for taking some time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you. Take care.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Mike Larson. In these next two segments, we are going to focus almost exclusively on the resource sector. And in terms of the resource sector, almost exclusively on the precious metals. We are chatting with Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, look, there's no denying that precious metals have garnered at least a little bit more of or intention out of investors on the back of that Fed statement, but then also really on the back of some of this higher inflation data. We're going to cover the broad aspects of the market, and then in the final segment of this weekend show, we're going to dive a bit more into some of the news, specifically out of some of the larger stocks and some of those M&A transactions we've seen on what has consistently been Monday over the last few weeks. Jeff, I want to recap a recent missive you sent out to everyone subscribed to the email list at the CPM Group, and that deals with gold and silver demand. Just simply on the demand side of things, please provide an update for us. What are you seeing in terms of investment demand for precious metals now?
Yeah, it's interesting because we're seeing pretty strong demand for physical gold and silver from investors. Coin sales, which are longer-term investors who buy based on the state of the world, the economy, political things, their own financial. Coin sales are up sharply this year. Small bars are up sharply this year. You're seeing very strong investment demand. And you're seeing a little bit of strange stuff like between the ETFs and the coin demand in that, you know, the coin buyers are buying when the price is low. And some of the ETF guys who are probably more shorter term trading oriented people, they'll buy low and then they'll sell high, but the coin people don't sell when it gets high. So, you know, you're seeing pretty strong demand for gold and silver on the part of investors. It was very high last year. Gold and silver investment demand probably doubled from 2019 to 2020. And what we're seeing this year is they're not doubling again, but they're staying very high. And we expect that to continue now for the next several years, actually.
Well, Jeff, as the great Frank Holmes always talks about, there's both the fear trade and the love trade with gold. And when we have the recent holiday of Diwali over in India and the Asian holiday and seasonal buying, do you see that shaping up to give any more demand to the precious metals? And how does that factor in with the fear trade?
I didn't see a tremendous increase in gold demand for Diwali this year. I mean, it was obviously earlier than usual, but I didn't see anything remarkable. But, you know, clearly that's there. The Chinese and Southeast Asian people who look at the Lunar New Year as a big buying opportunity, there is some interest there. There is some interest in precious metals, I guess you would say more out of fear than love, because of economic conditions within China and, you know, in the real estate market and also political conditions. You're seeing some increase in investment demand there, and that's probably going to continue. And then if you go away from Asia, you can talk about the fear and the love trades. You know, I mean, we look at the various things that stimulate investment demand, and a lot of it has been safe haven buying, portfolio diversification, currency hedge buying. But now, last week, all of a sudden, you saw a surge of what I guess you would call fear buying, which was based on the high PPI and CPI reports for October that were released during the past week by the United States BLS.
Jeff, let's also talk about some of the gold and silver inventories. We're definitely going to get into inflation and some of the economic data, but still focused on gold and silver. You've stated the gold and silver inventories are close to record highs. What are you seeing here? Why does this matter for investors?
I got called on the carpet by someone. Yeah, you know, look, gold and silver market inventories are at record highs. And for gold, it's probably record highs, you know, because investors don't sell their gold, they just accumulate it over time. But you're seeing record high levels of gold and silver stored in London and also in New York in reported market inventories and in China too. So there's ample silver and gold out there to meet this investment demand. You know, and you're seeing some people who are saying, oh, well, there's not enough silver. And, you know, I've heard claims that the U.S. Mint isn't even making silver coins. But the reality is that they're making more silver coins than they have for several years. I think that the production and sales of silver coins by the U.S. Mint is probably the highest level since 2016 this year. And it's definitely up from last year. So it's not a matter that they can't get the silver. That, you know, there's plenty of silver around. The U.S. Mint has had some issues with quality control on their blanks, but even in the face of that, you know, U.S. Silver Eagle coin sales through October were up 16-17% from a year ago, and they were double what they were in 2018-2019. So, you know, there's ample metal to meet investment demand, and investors are taking advantage of that.
Yeah, great point, Jeff. And a lot of times investors conflate the problems that the mints have getting the blanks with, hey, we're out of silver, which is not really the case at all. We have got plenty of silver. It's just sometimes some supply bottlenecks along the way. But let's shift it over into the inflation news that we got this last week. The CPI number came in at 6.2%, so running hotter than it was the month before, and really a lot higher than that 2% inflation the Fed said they wanted for about a year or two. They wanted to see that higher inflation. They wanted it to run hot. Well, it's running hot now, and the markets responded. We've seen a little bit of a boost in the gold and silver prices as a result. People have filtered in. We've got the taper underway from the Fed. What do you make of it all, Jeff?
Well, you know, inflation, the inflation data for October was much higher than we thought, and it was much more problematic than we've seen before. You know, we've seen higher inflation figures really for the last year over the course, you know, starting probably around February, March, April of this year, you've seen very high inflation numbers. But the inflation, the headline inflation, and even the headline inflation figures that we've seen have been primarily pushed by petroleum-based energy products and used cars. Those things were running 40% higher year over year from, say, March through June or July, through June. July, August, September, they came off. But you saw relatively, you saw some increases in the prices of other things year over year, but you're measuring against 2020 when, you know, for example, no one was driving, so gasoline prices were lower. But, you know, you were watching earlier this year in the summer, in the second and third quarters, you were watching inflation that was driven by those two major factors primarily. And if you look at the October data, prices were higher across the board, pretty much. You know, and so you saw much more inflationary pressures. That's a combination of increased demand and supply problems. And on the increased demand, people don't realize, you know, for example, they talk about the backup of ships wanting to offload in Long Beach City and Los Angeles, and they don't realize that, you know, U.S. imports are up like 27% from 2019 levels. Yeah, it's not that we've seen a recovery in demand of by U.S. consumers and corporations. We have seen an enormous expansion, and that expansion was probably occurring already in 2019. It was interrupted by the pandemic and the lockdown, but now that rise in demand for goods and services has skyrocketed. And so you've got this combination of, hey, we have to get back online at a time when people don't want to work anymore because they realize that life is more than work. But, you know, you've got this supply constraints, but you've got a big surge in demand. I think all of that works itself out over the next several quarters. You know, when the Fed used the term transitory inflation in the second quarter, there were a lot of people who jumped on it and thought that they were talking about 1 or 2 months. And we were saying, no, when the Fed talked about transitory inflation, they were talking maybe the next 12 months into early 2022. But by the time you get into mid-2022, a lot of those inflationary pressures ought to be expected to come down. That's what they meant. So we're still in that place where you could say this is transitory. But it is scary. And if you look at it month to month, which is probably a more accurate way to look at it because 2020 was such a messed up year, you know, we saw 0.9% changes in inflation in June. And then it came down and it was like 0.4% in August and September. It's back up to 0.9% in October. That's very worrisome because that's that month-to-month change in prices. And you're seeing it across the board now. So I think inflation, you know, we saw gold and silver prices rise sharply in response to the CPI figures, probably come off a little bit now. But I think that inflation continues to be an issue that drives investment demand for gold and silver for at least the next 3 or 4 months.
Okay, well, that's encouraging for precious metals investors. But look, I know there's unlimited amounts of debate whether transitory, just what time frame even the Fed was referring to, what transitory means, because quite frankly, it's open to interpretation what the definition time frame wise of transitory is. Plus, man, oh man, we hear so much about this supply chain issue. I've gotten tired of hearing about it because it seems like everybody is using it as an excuse. No matter what store you go into, it's almost a fallback excuse now for everybody. But the other side of the equation here that you outlined is that the consumer, right? That there's two sides to an inflation story. It's the supply side, which you can have shocks on the supply side that impacts inflation. But you also need that demand. People need to be buying products. And I'm seeing it around Vancouver. I'm seeing it in other places too, is that the consumer is still out there purchasing goods. I realize it's maybe not everybody, but there is still a what seems to be strong consumer base. What is this predicated on in your eyes, Jeff? Is it because everyone was locked down for, let's say, around a year, and now they have all this built-up demand? Was it also because the government was putting money into the bank accounts of individuals? What has led to this really explosion in the demand side of that equation?
Yeah, like I said, I think that, you know, possibly the demand increases were coiling up to rise sharply already in 2019, and it was kind of abrogated. But yeah, one of the major factors is because of the lockdown, there were any number of people who continued to A, earn money, and B, get a lot of money from the federal government, not just the United States, but around the world, you had a lot of government payments and income support programs that gave people a lot of money at a time when they couldn't spend it. Yeah, they weren't allowed to go out and eat. They weren't allowed to go out and shop. Stores were closed down. They didn't do traveling. You know, the incidence of driving, let alone aircraft and railroads and vacation taking and business travel, all of that contracted sharply at a time when there was a lot of money coming into people and they are spending it.
Well, Jeff, let me just ask you on the inflation. There's definitely the base effect year over year that we've seen, and there are these supply chain issues, but there's a lot of issues in inflation that were creeping up before this even came about and before there even was a pandemic. The oil and gas industry was underinvested in and was pushed back to get into renewables. The Biden administration blocked the Keystone Pipeline. Now they want to take the Line 5 offline. So some of those oil prices were going to rise anyways. And the oil prices were low in the previous year and actually went negative, and they were due to rebound up higher. But we're seeing rent up 16%. That's not a supply chain issue. We're seeing food at the grocery store that's domestic up something like 6 to 8% for most families at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that's not stuck in a tanker, from China on the LA shore. So there are some legitimate inflation things that are going to be stickier. How do you take apart the different parts, the parts that are base effect and supply chain, and how much of this is going to stick around for us, and what will the Fed policy be in response?
Yeah, well, first off, in terms of unpacking inflation, a lot of it has to be sort of guesswork right now because you really don't know. You can look at, for example, food, and there's been an increase in the demand side, and there have been supply problems. One of the astounding things that people have discovered through the news over the last few weeks is that the turnover rate for Series A intercity truck drivers is 90% a year in the United States. So a lot of the supply chain problems aren't ships at sea. It's that there aren't trucks there and you can't get, cereal from the northern Midwest to the coast and things like that. So you have to unpack it, but some of it clearly is also going to be non-transitory or secular inflation. And, if you look at food, if you look at clothing, you look at other issues, you're going to have to say, okay, the increase month to month or the increase year over year right now is 8% for this particular thing. And maybe 5% of that is transitory and goes away, but the other 3% stays. So you've got a much higher situation, and with apparel, for example, apparel prices have been very low for decades in terms of inflationary pressures. So you've got to unpack each sector and each segment of the economy and each segment of the price indices, has transitory and secular pressures. And that's really difficult. And the Fed, I have to say, the Fed has one of the best economics research teams, if not the best economic research team in the world. And they have an enormous team that just looks at inflation factors. They look at labor. They look at labor costs, and they estimate that stuff. I think the Fed is realizing that, they have to, William McChesney Martin said is the Fed's job is to lean into the breeze of inflation. Well, it's more than a breeze right now. But the Fed realizes they have to be somewhat less accommodating, but they also have to continue to keep the thing going. And as the Fed has said for 20, 30 years now, they can stanch the bleeding of a recession. They cannot cause long-term growth. All of that depends on better fiscal policy. And the fiscal policy system, which is set by the administration and the Congress, has been broken for decades in the United States. And it shows no signs of being repaired anytime soon. So you still have a lot of those issues. And the Fed has this terrible problem where, they're being charged with trying to keep the economy from rolling over into a depression and deflation, but they're not getting any support on the fiscal side. And there's only so much you can do with that monetary policy. And the Fed is saying, we'll do what we can, but you guys really need to get your fiscal house in order. And the Congress isn't doing that right now.
All right, Jeff, we're going to leave the inflation debate, I guess, behind us now, but undoubtedly we will be talking about that as we transition into next year. I do want to shift the focus into some of the news that's come out of the resource sector in terms of M&As. Over the last three Mondays, we have seen deals and some fairly big deals, the largest being Newcrest takeover of Pretium. That's $2.8 billion US. We also saw Gold Star Resources taken over by a Chinese company. Caliber took over Fiore. What's your takeaway from some of this M&A that we're seeing more in the larger and mid-tier miners?
Yeah, well, I think what you're seeing are several things. One is that, you know, the larger mining companies constantly have to look for replacement reserves and resources. And they haven't done a particularly great job in exploration and discovery. So the solution is buying reserves and resources by buying mid-tier companies. Yeah, you know, Pretium is a fabulous company. It really was fabulously well managed. They built Brucejack from, you know, from pasture land through permitting to construction to operation in an incredibly short period of time, given, you know, what happens with mining construction these days. They have an enormous mine with tremendous reserves and resources and low costs. They're a perfect addition to a company like Newcrest. They will lower the average cost and boost reserves and resources. So that's a really good one. And you're going to see more of those things because the majors really need to find reserves and resources, and they're not finding it through their exploration projects, not because the metal's not there, but because of the structural issues confronting modern-day exploration, mining exploration. So you're going to see more M&A. And you know, one of the things that we've picked up is, yes, the Chinese government has been saying to the Chinese industry, gold mining industry and mining and metals mining industry for some years, you guys really need to do a better job in finding and investing in attractive offshore properties. And you're seeing now this year a reiteration with emphasis of that stricture. You know, get out there and find good properties and invest in them. So I think that there's going to be increased competition in the M&A area, and it's one of the things that's going to happen.
Well, Jeff, just along this topic of M&A, we've heard from a couple different newsletter writers and analysts and people we bring on the show that this is what we need to do to attract generalists to this industry, is have these companies bulk up in size. So whether it's the Barrick Randgold or the Newmont Gold Corp or this Kirkland Lake Agnico Eagle, even this one with the Pretium and Newcrest, do you think it's going to make a difference that these companies get bigger where they actually get picked up by institutional funds, or do you think it's going to move the needle with the generalist investors?
I don't think it's going to move the needle. Yeah, I think the entire gold mining industry, you know, like the top 10, 20 companies, gold mining companies in the world could merge, and they'd still be too small for the largest asset management companies. And the largest asset management companies have their own problems. And, you know, part of the problem, I mean, we have a list of like six issues that are causing institutional investors to not invest in mining. And one or two of them have to do with mining. And the others have to do with changes within the institutional investment market that have nothing to do with mining and everything to do with moving away from asset management companies having analysts and portfolio managers study companies and invest in individual companies. They're moving away from that, and they're moving toward AI-generated funds, you know, indexed ETF funds, indexed funds that actually have been outperforming the performance of humanly managed funds at a lower cost for the fund management companies. And those things are nothing that have to do with mining and nothing that the mining industry can do to change, but they are going to continue to cause institutional investment into the mining industry to be distracted and contracting. So I don't think bulking up the companies will not boost institutional investing. I think, you know, really what you need to do is you know, work on lowering your costs and building your reserves and resources and having a well-operated company. And that will attract smaller funds and institutional investors and individual investors and family offices who are interested in profitable companies as opposed to large companies.
It's a process, right? But it all comes back to running these mining companies profitably. Seems like they should already be focused on that, but boy, oh boy, we have seen in the past companies get a bit distracted with maybe other aspects trying to build on that. Just a real quick question here regarding the Newcrest takeover of Pretium. This happened in the Golden Triangle. What are your thoughts on the Golden Triangle? Do you think that we could see some more consolidation within the Golden Triangle?
I'm not sure if we'll see consolidation, but there's definitely been an increased interest in exploring for and finding properties in that area. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see some of the properties that have been well known for years there actually start moving more rapidly into development toward production. And, you know, it's going to be increased competition for those properties. So, you know, the Golden Triangle in British Columbia is a very attractive prospective area. Pretium kind of proved that. Seabridge indicated that it was there. Pretium proved how easy, you know, how profitable it can be to move it forward. And I think that you're going to see more and more companies competing for space up there. I'm not sure if you'll see consolidation, but you'll see some of those properties bought by larger companies.
Okay, final question before I get you out of here, Jeff. What matters for precious metals investors moving into 2022?
I think one of the things that's going to matter, you know, we talked about this, is, you know, you look at that list of things. Inflation is going to be problematic going into 2022, but probably will wane as the year progresses. Interest rates will rise, but they're not going to rise so much that they're going to be problematic. Currency rates, the dollar will probably be relatively strong compared to what a lot of people expect. I think the big scary thing is going to be politics. Is it domestic U.S. politics, domestic politics in other countries, including some countries that other people think of as being sort of homogenous and stable? I think you're going to see a lot of domestic political unrest in major economies and nations. And then you're going to see increased tensions among countries and reduced cooperation among countries at the same time that you still have this massive growth in government deficits and private debt, borrowing, leading to ever larger debt. You know, we all look at the U.S. Treasury's debt, but the reality is that debt has been growing for corporations, for private individuals, and for all governments. And that is going to continue to hang over the economy and the financial markets throughout 2022 and probably for a couple years after that, at least.
All right, Jeff, we're wrapping it up here. Always interesting to get your thoughts. I appreciate you spending some time with us on this weekend show. If you're interested in more of what the CPM Group does, you can visit their website, cpmgroup.com. I'll also post a link on that weekend show posting. Everybody, thanks for tuning in on this weekend show. Again, please go back through the week on our website, kereport.com. Listen to all those company interviews and daily editorials that we recorded and posted throughout the week. We'll be back with you all next week. I hope you all have a very great weekend. Jeff, again, thanks for your time.
Thank you.